In the first hour of the show today, we'll be talking about the life and the work of one of the most influential film directors of the last 50 years, Alfred Hitchcock, a man who is well known for creating films that were both very well made and also very entertaining. He was also, due to the fact that he was a shrewd self-promoter, one of the perhaps most recognized or recognizable film directors. I expect we went out on the street and showed people pictures, they would know who Alfred Hitchcock was. At the same time, there were questions about just who he was and whether this persona that he created related to his real self and how that might be tangled up with the themes that he explored over and over again in his films. This morning, in this part of the show, I will be talking with Patrick McGilligan. He's the author of a new biography of Hitchcock, which is titled Alfred Hitchcock, A Life in Darkness and Light, published by Reagan Books, which is a division of HarperCollins. Our guest, Patrick McGilligan, has written a number of biographies of people involved in the business of making movies. He's written biographies of the directors Fritz Lang and George Cukor, as well as Robert Altman, and also written books about several actors, Clint Eastwood, Jack Nicholson, and James Cagney. If you have questions this morning, I'm sure that the guest would be happy to talk with you. If you'd like to call in, join the conversation. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Mr. McGilligan, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving.
Well, thanks, and the same to you. From one Midwesterner to another, I guess I was going to mention that you live in Milwaukee. I think probably not all that often that I actually talk to somebody in the same part of the country that I am.
Yeah, close by, actually.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, I think probably it is probably the case with many, many artists that it is difficult to disentangle them from their art. And certainly it is true with Hitchcock, and probably complicated, as I say, by the fact that he did create a persona for himself that may or may not have reflected who he really was. And there is always this temptation to look at the themes that he explored in his, you know, in his movies, some of them dark themes, and think that that was a reflection of his inner being. How does one disentangle the work from the man?
Well, I think in both cases there's truth. I mean, there's truth to the persona and the guise that he adopted. He adopted it for that reason. It gave him tremendous pleasure to put on a performance and pretend to be a certain kind of person. And that kind of person, with all of its darkly humorous quality, especially, I think you see it sort of at its zenith around the time of the television series and his greatest films from the mid-1950s to the mid-1960s, that he was enjoying himself to the hilt. And also that, you know, then became all he would tell us about him, that little disguise. And I think it's also true of his films. In other words, there's a lot of truth to the fact that if you analyze his films and look at them and understand them, that you get a good sense of the inner person. All of this, by the way, is part of his life story, and It evolves by degrees, and there's a lot of, and that's the fun for a biographer, and the fun for a biography is to separate out the truth from the illusion or the supposition, and then there's always still there's always elements of mystery in both cases, yeah, in terms of the person and the films.
Did he ever, though, feel hostage to the persona that he had created for himself?
Absolutely, and I wouldn't really say to the persona, but he certainly felt hostage to the stereotyping of himself as a suspenseful director. I mean, you see it way back early in his career in the 1940s in his personal letters. He saw what was happening. He facilitated it happening. I mean, he went back again and again to Jack the Ripper type films and suspenseful films, partly because that was how he could sell a project to producers and to studios. That was a very easy sell for him, whereas it was very difficult for him sometimes to mount more ambitious slice of life stories, and he had several that he intended to do over a period of time and was frustrated. So Yes, it was. You know, his story is full of setbacks and disappointments, and you know, various ways in which he was thwarted, as well as great triumphs.
He was attracted to the film industry when he was young, and when it was young, he started working in motion pictures when they were silent. What was it that about movies and movie making that drew him so?
Well, I think it was the great escape from real life, and I think he makes that point in his films over and over again, that he shows you aspects of real life and sometimes glimmers of real life events or incidents. And at the same time is always reminding you that he's giving you an escape. That's one of the reasons why he appears in his film. Very, very modern, sophisticated idea to let you know that he's the wizard behind the curtain, you know, pulling all the levers. It creates a distance from what you're watching, allows you to be entertained, even if it is sometimes very dark material. You have to say he wasn't only attracted to film, he was attracted to America. I mean, he was watching American films, he was interested in American methods. He liked to describe himself as a word he coined, an Americophile. And so from the moment he got his first job in film, he was working for an American branch studio in London, studying how to write scripts under American women who were brought over to write the first scripts. Working with Kodak and American camera equipment and American cameramen. And so he really, you know, he set his sights. He was very ambitious. He wanted to get out of the British film industry, which has always been a kind of weak sister, commercially as well as artistically to some extent. And he knew that Hollywood was the open door to the world.
Yeah. I think it's probably striking that that he really began as a writer, not so much. He began with stories and writing stories, and then went from that to the learning the craft of making the film.
Important theme of the book. Actually, one of the discoveries of the book is that I went back and found something like 8 short stories he had written as a young man for the first company that he worked for during World War I up until 1920-21, and that already as a young writer he's showing the full range of his imagination. You see in these early pieces, you see romance, you see triangular affairs, you see suspense and gruesome comedy, and you see trivial and quite amusing plays on words, all the kinds of things that he became famous for later on. And actually he was a writer initially. He entered as someone who could sketch the title cards and then write the captions, and then he was also a production designer and became an assistant director. But he was always the writer of his films, often with his wife as a collaborator, again a very important part of his life story, that Mrs. Hitchcock was at his side for over 50 years and that her skills were honed before his were, both in continuity, editing, and in script work. And then you see film by film, all the way through the British period, how he's guiding the scripts, and then how he makes a very concerted decision to take his name off the screen as a writer, but all the way through his Hollywood period is also bringing in writers, famous as well as obscure, veteran as well as very young people, and working with them always from page one. It wasn't fun for him unless he could start on page one and spend a lot of time working on the script and the story, which was always for him a kind of rehearsal for the visualization of what he would do once it became a film.
Just to pick up on one thing, the first thing that he did when he was working for the studio was writing title cards. I'm assuming that this is in a silent film. Occasionally there is script on the screen, which is the only way of them really to do exposition or tell you what's going on. That's what we're talking about?
Absolutely. And the goal of the title card writer was to write a clever title and to write as few as possible, and often to sketch a little funny little picture that went along with it.
When he made his last film, he was the only director still working that had started in silent films. Right?
Certainly that we know about in the English language. He was working in the English language, yes, at that point in time. And that was in 1976. And in 1972, he made Frenzy, which is about as good a film as a 70-year-old director ever made in his 70s. So, yes, he had outlasted other people, all of his peers, who had started in the silent era. And actually, what's really amazing about Hitchcock's life story, because as I say, there are degrees and stages to all of the things that we're talking about, is that he really peaked in the mid-1950s, starting really with the 1950s. Strangers on a Train is the first film of that decade. Then you have films like Rear Window, and then you have what I think are probably the three greatest films any director ever did in a row, both for their excellence and their variety, Vertigo, North by Northwest, and Psycho. So he was peaking with his talent, with his competence, and with his power at a point in time when the rest of Hollywood was really falling apart, and already most of the major directors of that era were retreating or retiring.
One of the things that I'm curious about is that the ways in which the fact that he started in silent films influenced his style and continued to influence his style in the way that he made movies, even into the era of sound.
Many of the great directors who started in the silent era ended up, you know, preferring silent film all the way through to the end of their careers, and would sometimes construct their films around, you know, beautiful, relatively silent visual sequences. I mean, the plane chasing after Cary Grant in North by Northwest. I mean, all we hear are sound effects, and it's one of the greatest sequences in cinema. Even the shower scene in Psycho, you know, we hear music, but that's it, and screams, and that's it. And that's what you would sometimes hear behind the greatest, often you would hear this behind the greatest Hitchcock sequences, only natural noise, unintelligible dialogue, screams, or music. And he would often choose a subject, take a look at various available projects, take a look at various available stories, and seize upon a scene or two inside those books or inside those possible stories that would lend themselves to that kind of treatment, and then spend more time in the preparation and development stage, the script stage, as well as the storyboarding stage, on that particular sequence than most directors spent on an entire film.
Hitchcock had a long association with film composer Bernard Herrmann, who has got to be on anyone's list of the great film composers, people who made music for movies. He would have to be very high on the list. Some people might put him number one.
Most people would, I think.
And so Hitchcock obviously understood this was important. And if you see the movies, you see how important it is. Who can think of the shower scene or hear that music that Herrmann wrote without thinking about that? The two things are so, you'll never get those two things apart.
Yes, and it's interesting because, you know, Hitchcock was actually very sophisticated about music, and early on in his career, sometimes would leave music entirely out of a film so he didn't have to deal with studio composers, because studios controlled their people who did the music, and then they would control the score. So, for example, Lifeboat, a film he made at 20th Century Fox, only has a little music under the beginning credits and the opening credits, and the whole rest of the film is just natural noise, wind, waves, the people talking, birds, very, 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 very radical. And so he would always try to minimize the studio composers, and then sometimes, because he had a great knowledge of popular songs, he loved Broadway musicals, he would throw in a particular song and then construct much of the entire plot around the song, or use the song from one of those bravura sequences. I mean, the best example is the 39 Steps. There's a little song running through Robert Donat's head through the whole movie, and he can't remember where he heard it, but where he heard it is absolutely essential to solving the storyline. So it wasn't, but it wasn't until Bernard Herrmann, which is at Paramount in 1954, that he got together with a composer that he truly admired, who really was simpatico with his work, and who began to work with him from the script stage so that he could feel totally confident about turning over whole sections of the film to him. And most people think that Bernard Herrmann wrote his greatest film music under Hitchcock or with Hitchcock.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Patrick McGilligan, he has written a lot about the movie business and about people who make movies, both actors and directors. He has a new book out that's a biography of Alfred Hitchcock. It's titled A Life in Darkness and Light. And people have questions, comments, so they want to join the conversation, that's certainly welcome. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us around Illinois, Indiana. If you happen to be listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you can use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here to talk with, someone in Piatt County, and that is on our line number 4. Hello.
I had a question. I was reading one time a book of short stories, and I came across Daphne du Maurier's Birds. And I believe that Hitchcock adapted, or I think that was the basis for his movie, but it is very different. And, I mean, it has the germ of the birds attacking, of course. But I just wondered if he was involved in the adaptation of that, or how he came, or if the author, Daphne du Maurier, offered him the short story, or if you just knew anything about that. And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
All right.
Yes, actually, as I said, he liked to be involved from the beginning. So that was a long short story that had originally been published in the 1950s and then republished in one of Hitchcock's mystery magazines and anthologies. So, yes, and I think it's very unsung what he did, because the entire story takes place in England, and he moved it to the San Francisco Bay Area. He moved a great number of films and stories to the Bay Area, and I think it's relatively, underappreciated how much work that was. And even before he had hired the screenwriter, Evan Hunter, he knew the sites, he knew where he wanted to put the scenes, he knew something about the characters, and so, and he knew who he wanted to be in the movie, in the film. So he knew all that before he sat down with the writer for the first day and said, now what will happen in the first scene? And he liked to have the story told to him by the writer, and from the beginning, over and over again, until he felt that he was both comfortable with it and there were no problems with it, and that he had rehearsed it. And they would do a lot of talking before they started writing. But The Birds is a great example of a film that he moved across the Atlantic, made very American, the story. Same with Vertigo, which is a French novel. Moved it to the Bay Area, all the way across the Atlantic, in time, too, because that's set in the World War II period in Paris and Marseille.
Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. When you read about his method of working, that one of the things that you see over and over again is just how carefully he thought about what the film was going to look like before he put anything on film. He very carefully thought, sort of shot by shot, plotted out the story, and there are quotes where he's quoted as saying that by the time that process was all finished, it was an anticlimax for him because he'd felt he'd actually made the movie, and he said, now I have to go out and shoot the damn thing. At the same time, you also read about his willingness once the film was made, that is, once it was committed to film, and they got to the editing process, to tweak things and not be so rigidly committed to what he started out with, to say, no, it's done. I knew what I was going to do. I knew how it was going to go together, and that's that. It seems that those two things are a little bit in conflict with one another, but I think
yeah.
that they're both true.
Well, there's truth in both truisms, but they're also both part of the pause, part of the pose. I mean, his longtime script assistant, Peggy Robertson, said, and I quote her in the book, saying that one of the problems with saying that he honored the script so faithfully is that we rarely had a script by the time we went into production. And it's one of the very interesting subtexts of his career, that it was a struggle for him. He was working against time and money often. For most of his career, he was a low-budget director. I mean, none of the films that he made in England would qualify as an A-budget on Hollywood grounds. And it isn't until he gets to Paramount again in the 1950s that he has more time, more money to do the kinds of things that he wanted to. So I find, I write about it in the book, that first of all, it's almost like a boxer working out for the big match. He works out, he's very disciplined, he plans things, and then if he's thrown a punch that he's not expecting, then he adapts, because he's very rehearsed and he's very disciplined. And you find him all the time improvising both on the set, as well as improvising in the editing room, shooting alternative endings, shooting alternative cuts. Everybody says everything is storyboarded so perfectly for something like the shower sequence in Psycho. Well, there were cuts, there were shots in the shower sequence that he dropped, including some very controversial ones, which he dropped deliberately to mollify the censors.
Let's talk with someone else. We have a caller in Normal over there on line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I've seen Psycho and other Alfred Hitchcock movies, but one thing I remember most of his was he had a television syndication of programs, and I was wondering how much he was involved with those, or if they were put under the production of other other directors or other producers.
Yes, his television series actually began at the same time that I'm talking about, the mid-1950s, which was a period of amazing work and creativity for him. He actually, when he came to Hollywood, tried to launch himself on radio as the host of a national weekly series of suspenseful stories. And then when that didn't work out because David O. Selznick opposed it, he started to do book anthologies already in the mid-1940s. So by the time his agent Lou Wasserman comes to him in 1953 or 54 and says, "Would you like to be on television? I think I could make a fabulous deal for you." He was already. He even had the backlog of material. So it's one of the things I talk about in the book. It hasn't been appreciated, I don't think, until now, how much he threw himself into that series. He loved the little acting things he did at the beginning and end of the show where he would make fun of the advertisers and do everything from being one of the Beatles to being a scarecrow in a cornfield where the birds are pecking at him. He would take any dare, you know, for his little acting vignettes. And then he directed three or four episodes a year, and some of those episodes, you know, there's a couple of them that are mini masterpieces, and most of it is elaborate groundwork and preparation for what we see in Psycho, a culmination of a certain style, a darkly humorous, terrifying story. He used his TV crew to shoot it, you know, et cetera. And he was okaying the stories, hiring the directors for the first series. For the first year, he produced everything, and then after that, he brought in his longtime associate, dating way back to England, Joan Harrison, and they collaborated very closely on the entire rest of the series so that the tone would always be Hitchcockian, a phrase that, you know, critics throw around quite recklessly nowadays, but that it would be very personal.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. Again, other questions or comments are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. You know, I'm just thinking about, we were talking earlier about the fact that he really started as a writer, and that is very important when you think about him and his work. His interest in story and creating story is very important. I'm also thinking about the famous comment from Hitchcock that story, in a sense, story doesn't, what the story is about doesn't matter that much. He had this famous term that he coined, the MacGuffin. And he said that was the thing that really drives the story. It could be the thing that people are chasing after or trying to figure out. And he said something like, in a way, it doesn't really, if it doesn't make sense, it doesn't matter. It almost doesn't matter what it is. It's the thing that is that drives the story and the plot, and that's what really is important. And
yes,
if it doesn't sort of make sense, you know,
the spy stories. And by the time it's explained at the end of some of them, it doesn't make any sense, and you
yeah.
can't remember.
Right.
And he doesn't really care. I mean, you know, to some extent, he was an absurdist, and I think that was a very sophisticated attitude. He said later on he didn't know who was up in that airplane attacking Cary Grant, and he didn't care. Nor does the audience. Nor do we care. And film after film, and he starts with this conceit early in, you know, in the sort of midway through the 1930s, early in his British career, where in films like 39 Steps, we have no idea what the secret is that the spies are after, and by the time it's finally explained, it's very difficult to recall or even think that it was all that important because so many other things are going on.
His films, if you look at the stories, fall into three main storylines, and the one that predominates, I think, it's the story that you just mentioned, titles of two films that fit into this category, 39 Steps and North by Northwest. This is the story of, it's the innocent man wrongly accused or suspected of a crime who has to then himself go out and figure out who is responsible in order to clear his name.
Yes, and often involving spies, saboteurs, or political terrorists of some sort.
What is it about this wrongly accused, this regular guy wrongly accused, just happens to be in the wrong place at the wrong time? What was it about that theme that interested him so much and made him want to return to it again and again?
Well, as usual, I think the answer with Hitchcock is several things, not just one thing. I mean, I talk about in the book, for example, that before he turns 21, he's already known one of England's most notorious murderesses who was wrongly convicted and executed, as well as one of England's most notorious political assassins, an IRA nationalist who killed a high government official and was rightly arrested, convicted, and executed, and that this influenced him. The whole idea, I think, of the wrong man is very personal, because he's someone who's always judged by the way he looked. He looked very odd. He was short. He was dumpy. He was bald at a young age. He didn't look like Cary Grant. And yet, you know, Cary Grant liked to say that Hitchcock wished he looked like Cary Grant, and I think he wished he did look like Cary Grant, which is why Cary Grant and Jimmy Stewart are two of his most frequent and greatest male stars. So he was a very conscious artist, and he saw things that way, which is that people judge by appearances, that appearances are often deceptive, that he could use this very simple idea, which was very personal to him, and use it as a major conceit of his films. I think, again, very sophisticated.
We have several callers here again, and we'll go on. We have somebody on a cell phone, so we'll get to them on line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. I'm only about a quarter of the way through the book, so this may actually be covered. But in the Truffaut book, he mentioned that in the early 30s, I believe, he has pitched the scenario that essentially was turned into Roman Holiday. And I was wondering if there were any other projects that were ultimately realized and successful by other directors that you know that Hitchcock may have passed over for whatever reason. I'll hang up to hear your answer.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I don't think there are examples of famous films that Hitchcock passed over and then other directors took up. And that's largely because, with only one or two exceptions, he began on every project at the script stage. And even when something went terribly awry, as it did, for example, with I Confess and 11th Hour, the script was gutted by the studio and new leads were forced upon him, he nonetheless shrugged his shoulders, being a very practical artist, and moved ahead and made the film. So there's not cases of projects that he worked on very long that were inherited by other directors. However, there are many examples in the book of films that he wanted to make, of stories that he dreamed of making, that he worked hard on at various points and couldn't get producers interested in them, part of the time because it involved too much expense and too much ambition, and part of the time because they said, but that's not a Hitchcock-type film. You know, they didn't see him as directing it. So I think most of the films that he ended up doing, I mean, he was very, and I think with Truffaut particularly, you know, relatively candid and pragmatic. He'd shrug his shoulders if a film he took to fruition didn't work out. He'd be happy if some people liked it, if it made money or if it won any awards. But he didn't, you know, he was very practical. So he very practically tried to work on something with a good contract from beginning to end, and otherwise didn't work on many things that were inherited by other directors.
Next caller is in southeastern Illinois on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Yeah, I would guess that he didn't so much wish that he looked like Cary Grant as he wished that the Madeline Carroll and the subsequent blondes thought he looked like Cary Grant. I'm not trying to bring him down or anything, because he was a giant, and there's no getting around that. But I think he benefited from the way that people looked at movies in his day compared with the way that people look at movies now. I mean, many people, and I'm one of them, if you like a movie, you watch it over and over again. I mean, it comes up on television time and again, or you buy a copy of a video of it and you watch it time and time again. And I think in many of the movies that I thought were so wonderful when I first saw them, they don't stand up under repeated viewing, because in so many, and you know, he did so many that this is not doesn't include all of them, but many of the more, well, like Notorious and some of the others. His women, which were one of his main attractions to me, come across as automatons. They don't seem to have any volition. I mean, he often went, I think, for an effect, and the first time you see it, it's effective. But as you watch the movie a few times, you realize that he is going for effect. An interesting, I, for example, like one of the movies that is generally, I think, considered a bad one, and that is Marnie, because you can watch Marnie over and over again, and that gal has a will of her own. I mean, she's a little, you know, she's not quite stable, but she does have a will, and you compare with her with Tippi Hedren in The Birds, and there you have more the automaton. In fact, I understand there was a story where at one point she's going up into the attic, the actress is, and she asks Hitchcock why she's going up there. And, you know, the birds are up there. Why would she be crazy enough to go up there? And he says, because I'm telling you to.
Yes, which he would often say to any actor or actress if they gave him any particular difficulty in a scene, because sometimes they didn't understand the entire context. I'm not sure I agree, because you mentioned notorious, and automaton is a pretty strong word. You know, frequently I see the women as endangered heroines, you know, in the tradition of Mary Pickford, which remembers the tradition that he grew up in, but also of Lillian Gish going down, you know, the river on an ice floe, who fight back, are very plucky, very resourceful, and, you know, turn out to be the heroines, you know, one way or another in the film. And it may be true that they don't seem to have the will of that you might wish they had, but the men, you know, at the same time are often and almost always impotent, unable to resolve a problem, fleeing from the police who are always hapless. And often it revolves around the women's decisions and the women's actions, the solution to the story, which is probably, you know, good drama, even, you know, more than it's any particular insight into Hitchcock.
Well, they're wonderful movies, but as I said, the women, you wonder, they seem to be doing what their actions seem to be outside of themselves, and they don't seem to be coming from inside. And I mean, I don't make that as a sweeping statement in all movies, because you know, many of the 39 steps and things like that. I mean, I get that impression in many of his more famous ones. Thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. We are a little bit past the midpoint here. In fact, we have about 15 minutes left. Our guest is Patrick McGilligan. He has authored biographies of a number of important figures in film history, including the directors Fritz Lang, George Cukor, Robert Altman. And he's also done biographies of Clint Eastwood, Jack Nicholson, James Cagney. His new book is a biography of Alfred Hitchcock, which is titled Alfred Hitchcock, A Life in Darkness and Light, and is published by Reagan Books, which is a division of HarperCollins. Is in bookstores now if you're interested in reading the book, so you can head out there and take a look at it. And, of course, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think over the years people have commented on Hitchcock's relationship with his leading ladies, saying that he was perhaps not altogether healthy and had a strange sort of psychological dimension that you see played out in the movies. Can you talk about that? Do you feel that you have an understanding of what that was about?
Well, I don't agree. I think, in general, he had wonderful relationships with his leading ladies. He gave them a lot of leash if he liked them. And if he didn't like them, he often would fight with them to varying degrees. He had a great variety of leading ladies, you know, everybody from Tallulah Bankhead to Ingrid Bergman to Grace Kelly. I don't think anybody would place any of those people, you know, in the same category of performance or as people. And he was tremendous good friends with the people that he worked with most often, because he liked to work with people that he was friends with. And so, for example, Ingrid Bergman and Grace Kelly, who were in more Hitchcock films than any other leading ladies, were very, very close to the family, you know, came and stayed with him up north because he lived in the Bay Area on weekends, went to the house for dinner. He planned and worked on scripts and films especially for them. They visited him on his deathbed. So I think that there are opposite examples, but, you know, and Tippi Hedren during Marnie is one, and I think it's one of the reasons why it's an arguably good film. When I show it to my film class, people chuckle because it seems very quaint and dated. So there's definitely... You know, there's definitely instances where he had trouble with his leading lady and with his leading men. But for the most part, he was really beloved by actors and gave some of those people opportunities for some of their greatest performances. I mean, you talk about people like Grace Kelly or Ingrid Bergman. They were never better than when they worked with Hitchcock, and the same goes for Cary Grant and Jimmy Stewart.
Well, those were certainly, I think, those four actors in particular were favorites of his, and he made movies with them over and over again. And I wonder what it was about them, particularly, I guess, about the men, and I guess, you know, maybe that's a silly question, because you look at Jimmy Stewart and Cary Grant, and you see in them a kind of big, sort of old-fashioned movie star power, screen presence in different ways. One, that sort of the very appealing everyman kind of figure, and the other, the sophisticated guy that we would all wish we could be.
Right.
So maybe maybe I've answered the question there. What was it about he felt about them that was so appealing and made them?
Well, one of the things that was true in his career was that it was always a struggle for him with casting, because he didn't control the casting of the stars up until the mid 1950s. I mean, even on Marnie, he preferred Grace Kelly and had written the script for Grace Kelly, who backed out at the last minute. So there were a lot of frustrations. He sought a kind of perfection. He sought a kind of actor and a kind of actress. I think in an actor, he wanted somebody complex, neurotic, on the screen, but very well behaved and businesslike as an actor off the screen. And he sought a certain beautiful perfection in his leading ladies, but also somebody who could give him a lot of emotion under certain circumstances and in certain scenes. So you can't do better than Cary Grant or Jimmy Stewart. In their day, they were considered absolute, you know, models. And great box office draws, by the way, besides being great actors. And he took all of this into account. So I don't think there are simple answers to why he gravitated towards this kind of person or that kind of person. Often it was a combination of things, and he had to like the people enormously. When he worked with somebody once and didn't get along with them, I'm thinking of Sylvia Sidney back in the mid-1930s, he never wanted to work with that person again. There's no question about it. Hmm. Nor would any director.
We have, as I said, we have about 10 minutes left, and if people have questions, certainly they're invited. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You'd like to give us a call. I guess I'm going back to this issue of him and the actresses, and perhaps some that he had difficult times with, and I suppose the one that stands out in my mind is poor Tippi in The Birds, and this famous story about how when he shot this climactic scene where she was being attacked by the birds. It's a very short scene, and yet they spent, I think, 5 days on it, throwing birds at Tippi, who initially thought they would be using either mechanical birds or, you know, she didn't think that she would have to stand there for 5 days having people throw live seagulls at her. But that indeed was the way that it worked out, and it begins to look like torture. You really wonder what was Hitchcock doing, and why did it take all that to shoot what in the movie is actually a very short sequence.
Well, he spent a week shooting the shower sequence. I don't think it's any more torture than Lillian Gish going down a river on the ice floe with D.W. Griffith filming her and doing it in real life, in real time, and risking her life. It's in the great tradition of the cinema to have these scenes where people suffer terribly, either realistically because they're actually doing it, or with some kind of illusion and special effects. There's also a lot of illusion and special effects in that particular scene. I think one of the things that makes The Birds great, and I think it is a great film, or certainly a near great film, is that this element of suffering and horror seems very, very real, and Hitchcock counted on that. And, you know, to say that Tippi didn't know what she was doing, I don't know. It was in the script. You know, Hitchcock himself at various points thought they might be able to do it with mechanical birds. There's no evidence that she was particularly hurt, and all the animal trainers and handlers and cast and crew were going to the hospital every day with bites and gouges. That was a very, very difficult film, but nobody was seriously hurt.
We talked a little bit earlier about the fact, I mentioned the fact that his movies fall into these three main themes, and we've talked about some of them. And in fact, your nominees for his three best movies, it's one of each of these from each of these categories: Vertigo, North by Northwest, and Psycho. The one is the film of the common man mistakenly accused of a crime. The other is centers around a woman which involves a man, and that ends up either destroying him or being saved by him. The third is the Psycho movie, movies like Psycho or Rear Window or Rope, those kinds of films that involve psychopathic killers. This is the one, and again, going back to what we were talking about at the beginning about sometimes the difficulty of disentangling the person with the art, these particularly, I think people have used them to say, now this is really a reflection of Hitchcock's dark inner psyche. And in fact, I think there was an author who wrote a popular biography that at least caught a lot of people's attention some time back that went as far as to suggest that if Hitchcock hadn't been able to make these movies about psycho killers, he would have been one. And again, I guess I want to get back to this idea of what he was inside and how that related to the kind of movies that he made, particularly those that fit into that category.
Well, first of all, you have to keep in mind that he grew up in an area where Jack the Ripper preyed upon people and was never caught, and that this was a common subject of conversation when he grew up. Believe me, we know who Ed Gein is and Jeffrey Dahmer is up here in Wisconsin. It kind of overshadows things when topics get around to crime or murder. So he really had this deeply rooted in his boyhood, and there was a real fascination with crime, which was very English also. And he followed this through because it was a strong suit for him from his first greatest film, The Lodger, up through The Psycho and Frenzy. But I think it's a little bit like saying, does Stephen King go out at night and kill people or do horrible things in order to get his inspiration? It's kind of silly. He knew what his strong suit was. He drew on real life. He used his imagination. And he was a tremendous hard worker with great craftsmanship, which is one of the reasons why he's so admired today among filmmakers and is really considered a kind of gold standard among filmmakers. And then he applied all of this to various subjects. But I think if you look at his career closely, I think most generalizations about him are just generalizations. I don't find anything terrifying about North by Northwest. It's a funny, richly romantic, very Kafkaesque film that you can see over and over again without feeling the slightest frisson of fear, except maybe on behalf of Cary Grant in the cornfield. I don't accept that Vertigo is a very typical Hitchcock film. In fact, I find it very atypical. There are a lot of his themes. It's very self-referential, like all of his work is. But at the same time, I think one of the reasons why critics around the world think of it as the greatest Hitchcock film, and it gets named in Sight and Sound's poll as the second greatest film of all time, not even the second greatest Hitchcock film, but the second greatest after Citizen Kane, is because it's so unusual. Because it takes a lot of what you think you know about Hitchcock and a lot of what you might be familiar with in terms of his ideas and themes and reworks them in a completely unusual context. The same with Psycho. I don't find, everybody has a Psycho story. It's like, where were you when John F. Kennedy was shot? And people are still terrified by that film. But that's just one branch of his work. And I think his work is much more rich and diverse than that, and that's one of the reasons why people really admire and love to re-see his films still.
We have another caller in Chicago, line 4. Hello.
Yes. You mentioned the film The Birds, and I had a question about The Birds. It struck me as almost an apocalyptic type of a film. And I'm just wondering, did Hitchcock intend this as social commentary, almost like nature striking back against man? Was that part of his theme in there?
Well, there was a big debate about it while they were working on the script and then all the way through the film. And, Hitchcock, if he had time and he had, production time, and he had enough time to think about a topic, it would usually get darker and more complex, the treatment of it on the screen. You have to say that that's in Daphne Naborie's story, which is very apocalyptic, and you are led, to the end, to a very similar ending, and you can form your own conclusions as to whether or not the birds are seeking some kind of revenge on mankind. And Hitchcock, I wouldn't mind if you came up with that solution to what exactly he's trying to say at the end, although they considered saying that very clearly, having a character say that very clearly in the script, and cut it out so that the ending would be more ambiguous and actually more faithful to Daphne du Maurier, who does exactly the same thing. The birds are massing for another attack as that story ends.
Okay, well, thank you.
All right,
thanks.
You mentioned just a moment ago that a lot of people believe that, would say that Vertigo was his greatest movie, and that this famous poll of people when they were voting, but the best movies of all time, always Citizen Kane comes up number one, but Vertigo comes up number two. So do you, and I know this is hard.
And every poll around the world, when Kane comes up.
And it's hard when you look at someone who's made as many movies as he has, but I wonder for you, do you have a personal favorite?
No, I really don't, and that's why I mentioned those three in a row, because that's what I tend to think of when people ask me about my personal favorites. And I don't write about people because they're my personal favorites or because their films are my personal favorites. And I think Hitchcock would be, you know, the man who called and said, well, we get to re-see his films over and over again. Yes, I'm not sure films are meant to be seen that way. I don't think you should see films over and over again looking for their deficiencies. You know, most of the great films that we're talking about now, North by Northwest, Vertigo, Psycho, certainly in the case of Vertigo and Psycho, Hitchcock owned them at the time of his death, and they hadn't been shown on television or re-released. He didn't like the idea that people would pore over these films. You know, that's one of the ways in which they could come back and say, well, there's no logic to the ending, you know, because there might not be logic to the ending. And I think he'd be, you know, kind of amazed that people sit around and watch these films over and over and over again, you know, hundreds of times, or that critics are naming Vertigo the second greatest film of all time. I'm not sure he would call it his greatest film.
Hmm. Well, it's certainly a great movie on the theme of obsession.
It's a great film, and I just shrink from calling it the second greatest film of all time, or that he would say so, or that I would say so, you know, that it's my favorite or anything like that.
So
you know, it's partly mood. I mean, you know, just take those three films. You'd have to be in a certain mood to watch North by Northwest and in a certain mood to watch Vertigo. Different, very different moods.
Yeah. And I think I'm not sure I would be ever in the proper mood to watch Psycho. I have seen the movie, and I guess I've probably seen it more than once, but I think probably I've seen it enough. So I don't think that was one that I would go back to.
Yeah, well, it's hundreds of times that makes me nervous, or dozens of times, you know. And people watch them frame by frame. You know, people have written frame by frame analyses of some of these films.
He was not, at the end of his life, was he happy? Did he feel satisfied with what he had accomplished? Obviously, it seemed that he was not happy that he came to a point where he felt that he couldn't
work
anymore.
No, and I think it's one of the reasons why you have this lingering suspicion that he had some kind of unhealthy attitude towards life. He had a very hard end, starting with The Birds. He had debilitating health, which got worse. His wife had a stroke. She was his best friend and creative partner. Many of the people in his inner circle either died or quit, so he was very isolated. He made a series of missteps, miscues with films like Topaz and Torn Curtain. And he saw his life was film, and he saw his life slipping away. And so there were, before that period of time, there's tremendous happiness and tremendous joy of life and joy in life and tremendous triumph, and really the last 15 years. And I think he sort of rebounds with frenzy, but really the personal side of his story for the last 15 years is very, very hard, very tragic. At the end, when he can no longer work, he goes home, and his doctor told me he was healthy enough to have lived longer with good care and not such a bad life, that there wasn't anything. He wasn't dying, but he was so despairing and so depressed over what had happened to him that he turned his face to the wall and he, you know, literally willed himself to death. And that's what his physician, who was the only person seeing him on a day-to-day basis at that point, told me.
Well, there we'll have to. I'm sorry, that's the note we end on, and we must, because the time is up. Again, for people who are interested in reading about the life and work of Alfred Hitchcock, you can look for the book we've mentioned by our guest Patrick McGilligan, Alfred Hitchcock, A Life in Darkness and Light. And thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.